And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can find us on Stitcher, same place, or however else you consume your podcasts. And you can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website is penonfire.com. My website is mariestone.com. You can find past podcasts up there as well. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We're devoting the full hour to fiction this morning, but we're doing it in kind of a fun way. Not only is my guest an author, she's also an editor and a professor, so we're going to be able to tackle writing from a lot of different angles this morning. Anne Napolitano is the author of the novels A Good Hard Look and Within Arm's Reach. She's also the associate editor of One Story Literary Magazine. She received an MFA from NYU and has taught fiction at Brooklyn College's MFA program. NYU's School of Continuing and Professional Studies and Gotham Writers Workshop. Her latest is Dear Edward. It's published by the Dial Press. It came out last month, and it is my pleasure to welcome her on. Anne, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming on. So that was sort of a broad strokes bio, but I'd love to take the first few minutes and have you talk about how kind of all this happened, sort of your micro steps to becoming a writer and an editor and a professor. And, you know, if it was sort of that traditional English major MFA path, or if it was kind of a more circuitous route.
Sure. I mean, I think it is always micro steps that add up to the full picture at this point. I basically took the traditional route. I decided basically that I wanted to be a writer when I was in fourth grade. But then I went through various degrees of sort of insecurity about that, you know, during my teenage years and into college. And in college, I majored in English literature with a concentration in creative writing. I specifically chose a college that had a creative writing professor or program, which really actually did limit the schools because a lot of schools at that point certainly didn't have it. So I went to Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut, which has an amazing writer who's been running that program for, I don't even know, maybe 30 years now. Her name's Blanche McCrary Boyd, and she has some amazing books. But while I was there, I thought probably that I would go into publishing and that I would sort of write on the side as a hobby because I just didn't think I was good enough. I knew that it wasn't sort of the career, the goal-oriented career that my parents wanted for me. You know, all the kind of things that you sort of neurotically worry about when you're college age,
right?
About what to do with the rest of your life. And then when I was right after my junior year, I got sick with a virus called Epstein-Barr, which is basically like it's like the mothership virus of mononucleosis. Yeah. And so what it does basically is wipes out your immune system and causes extreme fatigue, and it lasts like 3 years.
Mm.
So it took me an extra year to finish college. And when I went back for my senior year, I went back and took a very reduced schedule. I basically went back so that I didn't, like, lie depressed on my parents' couch. It was so that I could be with my friends and sort of have a life.
Mm.
But during that year, I realized because of that illness that, you know, that I wasn't immortal. When you're 20, you think you're immortal. Everyone around me thought that. Like, death and bad things happening to you seem so far away. But at that moment, I realized that I could be hit by a proverbial bus at virtually any time because this came out of nowhere. I was always extremely healthy, and since then, I've been extremely healthy. So it was literally like being hit by a bus. And so I decided in the middle of that illness that I was going to try and do what I wanted to do, and I was going to live my life to my highest dream, and that if I failed, then at least I would be failing. And so at that point, it took me an extra year to finish college, and then I went to New York University to get an MFA. And basically at that point, I was aware that I was kind of buying 2 years to sort of take your writing seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really great experience for me. I had an amazing professor, Danny Shapiro, who's an amazing memoirist and writer. And I met the two other writers that have been my first readers ever since, Hannah Tinty, who is one of the co-founders of One Story Magazine and an amazing novelist and writer, and Helen Ellis, who wrote most recently Southern Lady Code, which is a collection of essays, and before that, a book of short stories called American Housewife. She's amazing. So the three of us were in Danny Shapiro's workshop together, and all three of us are unpublished, and we made a commitment to each other to be each other's first readers, and we still are 20 or something years later. Yeah. So that was really seminal. And when I was in graduate school, I wrote my first novel, and I sent it out, and it was rejected by 80 agents. Wow. And I put it in the drawer, and then I wrote another novel while working as a personal assistant after graduate school, and that one I found an agent for, but she wasn't able to sell it, so I ended up putting that one in the drawer, too. And then I wrote my third novel, and that one ended up being published as my first book. And for teaching, that happened, so I didn't publish at all until I was 31, despite that being, like, the main focus of, you know, being the purported, you know, goal of my life and everything that I built, everything I did around that. And then when I had children, which was in my 30s, I wanted to try teaching. I think many writers think, well, you know, like this is a way to make money to support their writing in a way that feels meaningful still. And so I started teaching at Gotham Writers Workshop, which is famously open to taking inexperienced teachers and paying them very little money, but like giving them the infrastructure to learn how to teach the craft of writing. So it's a great place to start, because most places won't hire you to teach unless you've taught. So it ends up being a catch-22. So Gotham Writers Workshop is a wonderful sort of way to walk into that world. And so I've been teaching on and off ever since. And the editing began when I moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn, I guess 6 years ago. And Hannah Tinty, of course, has always been one of my best friends, and she ran One Story Magazine. So I've been like with One Story from the beginning, but not officially. But when I moved to Brooklyn and I moved two blocks away from the One Story office, Hannah was like, "Okay, it's time for you to start editing for us." And I was like, "Okay, that makes sense." Right. So I've been there for about 6 years as a, I think I'm called an associate editor.
Yeah, so great, so great. As you're talking, it's striking me, you know, I don't know if you know, so many people say the worst thing that happened to me turned out to sort of be the best thing that happened to me. And as you're talking about this illness in college, and sort of, you know, 3 years of feeling like your life just got derailed, I wonder if you look at that time as sort of the source for a lot of, because as I'm thinking through Dear Edward and I'm thinking through some of your other work, you can sort of see little vestigial crumbs that could have fed into some of the themes that come out in these books. And I wonder if you feel like that was sort of a transformative experience, not only for you personally, but also as your craft and art of writing as well.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it's interesting because, of course, we make up our own history and we have our own slants on how we remember what happened and like what we consider the seminal moments of our lives. And in my own, you know, construction of my own story, just for myself, it 100% is. It made me commit to writing. It changed the way that I lived, where all the choices that I made from then on, it's always been about constructing a life that feels like true to me and that is what I want to live and how I want my life to work. As opposed to worrying about exterior expectations or what I feel like I should be doing. And also, undeniably, the major theme of all of my work has been how to live a meaningful life.
Yeah.
And that definitely dialed in from that experience as well. So it's actually remarkable to me. Almost every time I look at something that I'm interested in, it somehow goes back to that period, which was personally terrible at the time, and it was sort of unthinkable to me that there would be what would be called a silver lining, but it really has ended up shaping who I am and my work and how I live my life.
Right, right. Did it also give you, I imagine it would just give you a lot of time. I don't know if you use that time for, if you're really flat on your back for reading and sort of reflecting and doing writing. I don't know how much energy we'd even have for any of that.
Yeah, no, that was part of why it was terrible. Oh. I mean, I had like 3 hours of energy a day. So I would use that energy for being with my friends or going to the classes that I was still going to. I was in a fog, so I didn't move forward in a, what felt like a productive way at all. It really was a sort of like an interruption to my intellectual life or development. I didn't do any writing during that period that was, meaningful in any way. But it did make me sort of figure out what I wanted to do from the moment that the fog lifted.
Right, right. You talk a lot about, and I love this visual, sort of this magnet board inside your chest, inside every person, I guess. But, you should pay attention to what pulls you in, what themes pull you, are pulled towards you into this kind of magnetic board, and how helpful that is for your work. And I thought that was such a lovely way to put it because... I think it's so important for writers to write authentically and what, their own unique story is. And we can talk more about One Story later. But I remember when I was at the One Story workshop 5 or 6 years ago, we did this great exercise where we all went to this really weird museum close to the One Story workshop.
Oh,
and
yeah, Anna does that.
Yeah, it was so fun. And we took our cell phones and we just took photos of kind of what was... kind of our own, we built this kind of cabinet of curiosities for ourselves. And looking across, we were all in the same place and there were, 30 of us or whatever. And just looking at what each of us paid attention to was a really useful exercise. And the way that you phrase that of this magnetic board, I think is so useful to writers. And maybe I'm not really doing it justice here if you want to expand on what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I don't know that I did it that summer that you were there, but since then I give a talk at the One Story Summer Workshop every summer, one of the afternoons, and it's about crafting your life as a writer. And one of the things that I do always talk about and basically talk about every single time I teach anything is this idea, because it was so helpful to me when I realized it. So what I imagine is that each of us, and not just writers and artists, like every human being has a magnet board, a specifically calibrated magnet board inside them. And so I picture it as like a flat magnetic board that fills up your torso like a rectangle. And the things that pull to your magnet board are completely different than what pulls to your spouse or your best friend or your twin sister. And what that means is that which headline in the newspaper, which bit of gossip, which documentary on the 517 channels that you have that call your name. Which book do you reach for on a bookshelf? Because something inside of you says that you should read the back of it and see what it's about. So the things that pull to our boards are completely individual to something that makes us up, like a combination of our DNA and our history and our experience and our personality, etc. That sets that. And the thing is that we have to listen, particularly if you're an artist or writer, you have to listen with intention and pay attention to what it is that's thwacking against your board, because our world is so noisy and we are so inundated with information all the time that if we don't pay attention, it's completely possible to go through an entire life without being aware that there are things that stick to you. So we have to keep those channels open and keep paying attention. There's a writer... she's passed away, but a writer and artist named Amy Krauss Rosenthal, and she had a wonderful piece of written art that said, pay attention to what you pay attention to.
Hmm.
And once I started, the thing is, once you do start paying attention to what you're paying attention to, and you realize that the things that are calling out to you are calling out just to you, and that means that they probably have something to do with your work or your subjects or your themes, it makes your life much more interesting, and it also means that you stop talking yourself out of paying attention to things that you think are quote-unquote weird or or inappropriate. Like, it's entirely possible that there's some bit of gossip where you're like, I need to know everything about that one divorce. But there's this voice in your head that's like, no, you know, like, it's gossip. It's beneath you. You shouldn't be doing that. And there was an elderly woman who was in one of my one-story classes a few years ago now. And when I was giving this talk, she raised her hand and said that every morning of her adult life, she had scoured the newspaper for stories about dead babies. And she had never told anyone, including her husband, because she felt like that meant that there was something deeply broken inside of her. And this way of looking at it made her feel like there was probably something there that she needed to write toward. There was something in that dark place that, you know, concerned her work. And the fact that she was denying it to herself the whole time just slows down the process. So I think the more we can, the more it makes us more curious. It makes our lives richer. It takes out needless guilt. And it's enriching both to us personally and to our work to pay attention.
Do you journal about it, or how do you keep track of it? Do you just kind of mentally note it and that's enough, or do you kind of take notes about it?
I recommend when people are beginning to think about this, that they journal about it, or just that they journal every day, because that will make them write down random things, and then they can start paying attention to that. I do journal, but not – I keep like a gratitude journal, and also I take a picture every day. There's actually an app that I have on my phone called – I think it's called the 5-Minute Journal, and I've been using it for, I don't know, 5 years now or something. It's great. And you choose a picture of the day, and then you write down three things you're grateful for. And then there's actually some other things you can do. Like at the end of the day, you can say like, what was great. But all I do is I put in a picture every day and I type in three things I'm grateful for. But that makes me actually document my life. It makes me take pictures of things that I wouldn't take pictures of otherwise.
Yeah.
And so like little things like that can be very helpful to like to hone yourself to be paying attention to what's going on around you.
That's super interesting. Huh?
Yeah. And then the bigger things, like I have found that, so the book I wrote before Dear Edward, A Good Hard Look, Flannery O'Connor, the short story writer, is in that book. And when I was a senior in college, actually when I was sick, I did my thesis or whatever for my creative writing focus. And the Blanche McCrary Boyd, the teacher I spoke of, part of her job was to assign a stack of books for me to read as part of my thesis that year. And she decided to assign to me, which is very Blanche, a pile of huge books that she had always wanted to read but hadn't read yet, so that I would read them and then tell her if she should read them.
Brilliant.
Brilliant and hilarious.
Yeah.
And one of the huge books that she assigned to me, so they had nothing to do with me, per se. It was like just these books that Blanche had been thinking that she should read for like 30 years, and she decided to use me and my youth and my ability
great.
To get things done. So one of the books that I read as part of that was The Habit of Being, which is the collection of Flannery O'Connor's letters.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a monster. It's like 1,200 pages.
Yeah.
So I had read that book as part of my thesis, and I thought it was great because I had sort of found Flannery O'Connor very intimidating, which she is, very intimidating until that point. And her letters, she had lupus, and she had to move back in with her mother when she was about 29 years old. And so most of her relationships and friendships and everything were conducted by letters, and she was hilarious, and they're just great. But so I had read that my senior year of college and then never thought about it again. And then, as I said, I didn't sell several books. So, like, it was like 4 books later, I was writing a book. I thought about this man named Melvin Whiteson who couldn't figure out what to do with his life. And Flannery O'Connor showed up in this book. And and I was horrified and confused. And I didn't want her there. I didn't want to write a historical novel. I'm from New Jersey, and Flannery O'Connor is a Southern literary icon, and you're just really not supposed to write about, you know, Southern literary icons unless you're from the South. So I really fought it, And that writing that book was very unpleasant for a long time. It was really difficult because then once I realized she wasn't going anywhere, I needed to make sure the book was good enough to have Flannery O'Connor in it without being disrespectful to her legacy, etc. But so what I think happened in retrospect was that when I read those, The Habit of Being, while I was sick in my senior year, I was reading about this woman who was very ill and who sort of honed her life down to what was most important and wrote her butt off for like the last remaining 7 years of her life and produced just work of staggering quality despite the fact that she was sick. Yeah. I think that book and her stuck to my magnet board, but I wasn't paying attention. I was young. I was inundated with information. I was in a fog. I didn't know who I was or what pulled to me. It didn't even occur to me that was an idea. And so when she showed up, I fought it. Whereas with Dear Edward, I became obsessed with a story in the news about a real plane crash, and I didn't fight it this time because I saw the same signs, and I was paying attention now. And so it was so much smoother and so much easier because I just embraced it with everything that was in me.
So great. So
that's my long-winded explanation of how it plays out, I think.
The only thing that I would add to that as you're talking, I had just edited this article yesterday about creativity, and the author was making the point that you really have to fill up it's very difficult to be creative if you don't have a broad and deep knowledge base to begin with, because what the brain and subconscious does is make all of these leaps and connections between disparate and unrelated material. And so you really have to fill up your well with a bunch of random stuff in order to be creative. You have to have something to jump off from. And so your point about, you know, reading all of these, I love that this professor assigned all these weird books that she wanted to read.
Yeah.
But the great thing about that is that now you have just this massive creative well down deep that your subconscious can just dip into whenever it needs to make these connections that, you know, I guess could be inconvenient if you don't want to write about Flannery O'Connor, but what a wonderful thing, because it's probably hard to be creative without, you know, all of that stuff in there to use. So that's
wonderful. I agree, but I think most people have that. I mean, and the more you pay attention and the more you sort of indulge your curiosities and obsessions and like weird things that interest you, the more you have in there. But I do think that most of us have that. Yeah. Even if you just, you know, watched 80s sitcoms as like an obsession for, you know,
right,
a period of time, you're going to have a wealth of information from that.
Right.
And that's what's interesting too, like about following your own path, because, you know, I don't know anything about 80s sitcoms at this point, but someone else has a PhD in it.
Right. I thought of this exercise. So right after that one story seminar, my husband and daughter and I were walking down a street in Boston. We've never been to Boston, and we were looking around. And at the exact same moment, all three of us stopped and were like, look at that. And all three of us were looking at totally different things. I was looking down this manhole.
Interesting.
I know.
I love that.
I was looking down a manhole, and I was like, what's under there? What's under the underground? And, you know, they were obviously looking at more pleasant things, but yeah, it was funny. I was like, we're all in the same place, same time, looking at, you know.
Yeah, that's great. And but like that makes you, in theory, like delight in each other all the more,
right?
You know, because like how boring if we were all like pointing at the same thing.
Exactly right. My guest this morning is Anne Napolitano. The book we are about to talk about right now is Dear Edward, and you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So that's a great segue for you to introduce your obsession and what you were interested in when Dear Edward took flight, sort of. That's a terrible pun, I'm sorry. But anyway, kind of take us into the book.
Sure. So in 2010... I became obsessed with a sort of a headline in the news, and it was there was a real plane crash. There was a flight from South Africa bound for London, and it was mostly Dutch passengers on board that were on their way home from vacation, and the flight crashed in Libya, and there was only one survivor, and it was a 9-year-old Dutch boy, and they found him still buckled into his plane seat about a half mile away from the rest of the wreckage, and he had a punctured lung, and he had a broken leg, but he was otherwise fine. and everyone else on board, including his parents and his brother, had died immediately. And this was a huge news at the time. It was on all the, the news stations. It was, the headline of the New York Times. Everyone was talking about it. Very few people seem to remember it now because so many things happen so many days in a row that we can't keep it all in our heads. But I immediately couldn't read enough about this story. And also in 2010, social media had just sort of crested to the place where we would recognize it as what it is now, where really in 2010 was the first time that everyone you knew was on Facebook, including your mother. And so it wasn't only journalists who were weighing in on this international news event. There were girls, little girls around the same age as the Dutch boy who had created Facebook pages in his name, where they would write about how sad they were for him and how cute he was. There were airplane aficionados who were speculating about why the plane might have crashed because they didn't know. There was a leak from inside the hospital in Libya that the president of Libya had called the little Dutch boy to wish him well in the hospital. So there was all this sort of, for the first time, I was viewing a huge news event in a kind of 360-degree way where it wasn't just the gatekeepers that were reporting it.
Mm-hmm.
And this little boy was immediately famous in everyday homes. And so there were a number of elements that were really fascinating to me. And there was a picture of him that accompanied virtually every article. And it was a photo of him in his hospital bed. And he was 9 years old, and he was so beautiful and looked so broken and small. And I had two little boys at the time. They were 1 and 3. And I would just look at the picture and think, how is that little boy possibly going to be able to climb out of that hospital bed and leave that hospital without his mom and his dad and his brother? How could he do that? How could he go into a new life without them? I wanted to know that he could be okay, and I couldn't imagine how he could after going through something like that. So in a way, the level of the obsession and the stickiness of it made me know almost immediately that it was something that I was going to have to write my way into.
Mm-hmm.
And what I ended up trying to do was to create a set of fictional circumstances in which a little boy who had been through something like that could be okay.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on it for 8 years, so it took me a long time to figure out if that was possible or to find the way, to make that in the most nuanced way possible.
Right. It strikes me also, I live in Southern California. I spent a little bit of time, 6 months in New York after 9/11, but it strikes me that it would be very hard to live in New York after 9/11 and see any sort of tragedy like this happen without it sticking to your board. And I don't know if any of that played into this, that you would look out and you wouldn't see those buildings anymore. And if you feel like that is, some subterranean backdrop to any of what your areas of concern are now.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I was living in New York on 9/11 and have been living here since I went to graduate school in the mid-90s. And actually, the thing that I think that's definitely part of it, and there are references to 9/11 in the book, because I feel like Edward's parents lived, they all lived in New York City, but his parents were living there during 9/11, and if you did live here then, it's sort of just imprinted into your psyche.
Yeah.
But the thing that actually I think of in relation to the book for 9/11 was that I was watching the Today Show and eating breakfast, about to go to work, and so I was watching the news when the planes went in, and one of the most remarkable things was that hundreds of people immediately rushed to the New York City hospitals. New Yorkers rushed to the New York City hospitals to donate blood because they assumed that there were going to be survivors, and there were lines going down the street that morning for people donating blood. And then at the same time, on the same day, as the news of what was happening, filled all of the news programs all over the world, emergency responders in the United States, all the way across the United States, got into their trucks and cars and started driving across the country to New York City so that they could help. Mm-hmm. And as they arrived in New York and were driving down the West Side Highway, New Yorkers lined the highway and were applauding them as they arrived. And that human response to step forward and be like, how can I help? What do I have? Where do I show up? And what can I do? Which was so stark on that day and then the days that followed. It's like the most beautiful part of our humanity shows up when the most horrible things happen. And so that's so moving to me. And in the book, I realized that the only way that Edward could end up being okay is if he was shown a tremendous amount of kindness. Mm-hmm. And so the people in the new world that he starts, he moves in with his aunt and uncle in New Jersey, they adopt him. And all the people in that new world step forward and try to be helpful in their own flawed human ways. And so it's that makes 9/11 resonate for me in a way that's not tragic.
Mm-hmm. So beautiful. I understand it's not a choice to have the point of view character, a 12-year-old boy. I mean, that's kind of baked into what the story was always going to be. But I've been talking to writers recently about that choice, Ann Patchett with The Dutch House and Alexis Shaken most recently with St. X, and having narrators tell the story from that kind of preteen point of view that I think is a really interesting point of view, because we were talking about it before as they're slightly unreliable narrators, not because they want to be, but because they just don't have the experience and kind of adult perspective to see situations in the same way, which I think makes them really interesting narrators. And I've heard editors sometimes shy away from little kid, you know, it's not a young adult novel, and so them shying away from young point of view narrators. So I just kind of wanted to talk through that a little bit and what Edward's age gave to him that was either helpful or difficult to work with for you, and if you got any pushback from telling the story through the point of view of a preteen entering teen, you know, then becoming a teen.
Yeah. I mean, you're right that, yeah, my orientation point was always a little boy because the real event had happened to a little boy. The Dutch boy was 9 years old when the plane crashed, and I deliberately made Edward 12 years old because I think it is such an interesting time and age in our human development. And 12, because you're still a kid, you're still a little kid, but you're right on the edge of becoming a teenager. And I knew that, I mean, in the book, he goes from being 12 to being 18 by the end of the book. So I take him through his adolescence. And I thought that was very appealing to me because you're on a trajectory that's universal, that we're all on, that we all go through. So he had to go through that as well as go through healing or figuring out who he could be after having survived this event. But the sort of the trajectory of the sort of built-in infrastructure of adolescence was helpful to me because a grown-up could sort of disappear for 8 years into the morass of their grief in a way that you can't when you're that young, because you have this sort of adult, you have school, you have people watching you, you have, you know, there are expectations. You have to do as you're told when you're a child, and you don't have to do what you're told when you're 41. So all those things were appealing. And nobody, when I was writing Dear Edward, I didn't think that it would necessarily sell. Because the two books prior, my first two books, had both been well-received and well-reviewed, but didn't sell very well at all. And so that made me like a mid-list, mid-career author, which is not optimal. In general, the publishing world would either like you to be an exciting debut or to be sort of like have, you know, made each book have been more successful than the one before it. So you seem to be like on the climb as opposed to. And I was none of those things. So I wrote this book without much. The only people who read it while I was writing it for about 7 years was Hannah Tinty and Helen Ellis. And I didn't give it to my agent until it was done. And then she gave me some notes, and I went away and wrote, rewrote for like 6 months after her notes, which were great. So with no expectations on you, there's like no limitation to what you do. And it never even occurred to me, like, nor would I have cared, but like no one was paying any, you know, no one was like, oh, I hope she writes, you know, something that is commercial. They were just forgetting that I wrote, basically.
Oh, geez.
Which was
right,
fine.
I mean, I get it.
It took me 8 years, and I loved writing it, so I was not unhappy. It just, I was so removed from that part of the industry that it just wasn't relevant.
Right, right. I heard that you approached this book a little bit different than you did your last books, and this was some, I feel like I read this with some advice from your husband, but that the prior books, perhaps you just sat down and wrote, you know, what sounded pretty or what sounded good at the time. And this book you really sat with for some period of time, like a year, to really think through it structurally, think through what the storyline was going to be. Did I misread all that, or is that accurate?
No, that's correct. I mean, I said in this discussion that writing A Good Hard Look with Flannery showing up was really challenging. And I guess I would have always described myself prior to this as an intuitive writer. So the idea that, like, I would just start writing a scene and then someone would walk in and say something that I didn't expect, and that would create something else that would happen, which is, like, a wonderful way to write because it's an act of discovery and it's like reading, basically. Mm-hmm. And there's the famous E.L. Doctorow quote that writing a novel is like driving home on a foggy night. You can only see as far as the end of your headlights, but that's far enough to get you home. So I would always like know one thing ahead, and then I would write towards that, and then the next thing would appear. And that worked really well for what ended up being my first novel. But when I was writing the book with Flannery in it, I felt like I had a very deliberately sort of unmotivated main character, this man named Melvin. And so with him sort of meandering and confused and then me trying to intuitively figure things out, I ended up like making figure eights, and I wrote like 400 pages of, you know, one story and then deleted it. And it was very frustrating. And so my husband had watched me go through that process. And then when I'd finished that book and sold it, he suggested that, that I do it differently the next time. And then his challenge was that I not write for the first year, that I just, think about the book, take notes, do research, and read widely, but deliberately not let myself write pretty sentences, which is my favorite place. And it's, I realized during that year process several things, but one is that when I am writing pretty sentences and I'm in a scene, for whatever reason, my cerebral brain sort of switches off. I can't think analytically about, like, the bigger picture of the book or the plot or the structure when I'm writing. So it was extremely helpful. So for Dear Edward, that's what I did for the first year. And I mean, largely as a result of that, the whole writing process of Dear Edward was really a joy for me as opposed to the prior experience.
Yeah, that's a really good insight. And do you think you'll approach the next one the same way?
Yeah, I'm almost at the end of the year of thinking and taking notes for the next one. So absolutely, I think this will be something I'm not going to stop doing going forward.
You can feel yourself get, or I could feel myself getting itchy of, you know, okay, now I really want to write, but it's almost like a racehorse that you have to hold back into the stall, right? That they're ready to go.
It is. I mean, particularly with Dear Edward, I found it really frustrating because I just wasn't even sure if it was a good idea at that point. And I was like, you know, I do need to write in order to feel like a whole human being. That was very tricky, although I kind of tried to trick myself by the fact, obviously, that I was thinking about it and taking notes and things like that. This time has been much easier because the sort of lead-in for Dear Edward has been so busy that I've been distracted. So I've sort of put the writing time towards Dear Edward, you know, promotion. And then on the side, I've been taking notes and thinking. And so it sort of scratched the creativity itch.
Right, right, right.
But that was just lucky.
Do the notes that you take look sort of like an outline, or do they look like, because we should also mention that there's a pretty big cast of characters in here. There are two timelines, post-crash and on the airplane, that switch back and forth. And on the airplane, you know, there's a big cast of characters who are passengers on the airplane whose stories, you know, you have to follow. So that's, you know, as a writer, probably a lot of information to keep track of. And I don't know how much information you had about every character that you write about on the plane, every passenger and their backstory and their, you know, who they were. So the notes look kind of just like sketches of these people, or is it a full outline, or what does that kind of look like?
Well, for doing Dear Edward, for the first time I used a program called Scrivener.
Oh, yeah.
You're familiar with that. So it's a V instead of a B in the middle, Scrivener. And that ended up being really helpful because you can pull all of your research into one place, like even links, and they can put them in folders. And it also has like a corkboard setting where it literally looks like you have index cards pinned up to a corkboard. So for a while, I had index, you know, these virtual index cards for each passenger, and that's where I would sort of put in everything that I thought about them and backstory. And then during that year, I also I figured out who I wanted to follow on the plane. And the gift as a writer for that plane journey was that everyone flies. So I had the opportunity to go into characters who are extremely different from each other, which is not an opportunity you have if you're writing about a family living in a house or whatever.
Right.
So I was really excited, actually, by the idea that I could follow people who are so different from each other. And then as I came up with each person, I would read and do research for that person. Like Crispin Cox is the sort of billionaire capitalist in First Class. And I read the autobiography of Jack Welch, who ran GE for like 30 years, and it's called Straight from the Gut. And like, it's hilarious. I mean, it's not supposed to be hilarious, but it's hilarious. And so I read that for him. And for the soldier on the plane, I read a wonderful nonfiction book called War by Sebastian Younger. And I have a friend who's in the military. Edward's father is a pure mathematician. I read a book about math by David Foster Wallace.
Wow.
My husband had also challenged me during that year to read outside of my normal genre, which would be literary fiction, just to sort of expand everything. And so one of the things that I read that year was the Sandman series by Neil Gaiman.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And reading that made me come up with Florida, because Gaiman sort of so joyfully disregards virtually every boundary of time, space.
right.
You know, he has characters that are death and life and dream. And so I thought, well, yeah, why can't I have character who believes that she's had many lives? Like, so it was nice during that period to have the space to sort of map those people out and really just sort of think about it until they were fully realized people for me.
I love how airplanes are just delineated by class. I mean, how you can have conversations about class, and airplanes, you know, are so obvious about it. These are the first class people.
And
they're wealthy.
Anyway. Yeah. And you have to walk past them on your way.
Right.
Your feet in the back of the plane. And they're
right.
Like lounging and their feet up.
And you can kind of play with that with Edward's family too. You know that his I don't want to give too much away, but his you know that his family is kind of divided up between the classes for different reasons. And I don't know. It gives you a lot of freedom to play. And you're right that everybody flies, so you get this wonderful opportunity to really explore a lot of different people. That's cool.
Yeah.
Was there somebody that gave you more trouble than others, or you know that you really struggled with, or you know was there a character that was you know, you just inaccessible to you, and how did you get at them?
It wasn't the people on the plane. The plane was the easiest. I mean, because of the year of preparation, obviously the Plains storyline was the easiest thing for me to write. And in large part, I knew the people, and then there was an obvious beginning, middle, and end. They're all trapped in, you know, a space the size of a bus, so there's only so much that can happen. I had all these limitations that made that the creation of that storyline come fairly easily. It was what happened on the ground that was much more challenging. The biggest challenge was Edward, but additionally to that, I had problems with Lacey and John, his aunt and uncle. I didn't really get them right until after I sold the book and was and edited it with my editor. But Edward was, his storyline is the one that I wrote and rewrote and rewrote, because anything could happen to him, and trying to find the correct, like, emotional path for him, it just took you know, tiny modulations and big modulations, and it took the most time.
Yeah. One thing that strikes me that I don't know if it would be easier for you or it would get in your way is being an editor during the writing process, because, you know, we all have this inner editor, and maybe the fact that you planned this out for a year before you sat down to write it was really helpful in this regard. But it just seems like it would be extra hard to turn off the inner editor when it's already hard for writers to do that when you are an editor. And I was wondering if that helped or hurt you in the writing process.
I mean, I tend to think it helps. I really do try to embrace the sort of Anne Lamott quote of, like, write shitty first drafts. And I always urge my students to do the same. So when I'm bringing my editing brain to something, which, for instance, you know, would be the stories that are submitted to One Story or stories or fiction that I read for my students, the ones that are submitted to One Story, the idea is that that's the ultimate draft. Like, that's the finished version. The writer has taken it as far as they can. And so I bring a different set of expectations to that than I do to anywhere before that. If I'm reading students' work and we're going to discuss it in class, I'm hoping that they've handed in something that they're not entirely happy with, that, like, has taken risks, that they're not sure if worked, and things like that. And so when I edit for teaching, I have a very sort of open, like, looking at the potential of the work and what's been done beautifully and what could be improved to, you know, raise the level of it. And then when I'm looking at my own work while I do it, I have a high standard. I have a very high standard, personal standard for where it needs to get to. But I don't hold that to earlier drafts. I sort of am happy about the parts that I can feel coming easily and working right away, and the parts that aren't, I just relentlessly rewrite them. Mm-hmm. But not with any kind of negativity at myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, it'd be interesting to talk about the aunt and uncle in regards to that. So, they're woven in, obviously, throughout the entire book, Lacey and John. And once you figure out that their characters aren't working, you revisit every scene that they're in and kind of play with those scenes, or you'd kind of lift those scenes out and completely rewrite them, or... Like, I'm just really interested in this idea that something's not working and it's already structurally woven in there, and how you go about fixing it from there.
Yeah, I think the first thing was realizing why they were a problem, which I did not realize until the end. I think the way in that they didn't work was that they were thin. They didn't feel as fully realized as all the other characters.
Mm-hmm.
And also they felt there were such critical figures in Edward's life that it wasn't appropriate for them to be sort of as thin as they were. And then, so what I realized during the final editing process is the reason that they were thin was because they were the ones living with Edward, and I was in Edward's orientation. Like, it was through him that I was feeling that the whole on-the-ground storyline. The two grown-ups in his life, the two main ones, were Lacey and John. So the fact that I was inside of him made it really difficult for me as the writer to sort of step out and step into them. if that makes sense.
That does make sense,
and,
yeah.
And I wasn't going into their, I deliberately wasn't going into their points of view, because I go into the, I go into many points of view on the plane, and so I had made early on the conscious decision to only be in Edward's point of view on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that sort of, like, where I was centered being him, that's why they ended up being Ben. And I really couldn't see it for a long time as well because I was looking at it from him. But once I realized that that was the problem, it was the end of the process, I was able to sort of step out of Edward and look at their marriage and look at the, like, there were, like, two moments that worked with them. And I could look at those two moments and be like, oh, that's because they're, like, there's a moment that's still in the second chapter of the book where John and Lacey are in Colorado in the hospital with Edward. The plane has just crashed and everyone's reeling, and Edward's only just found out that his family has died. And someone comes into the hospital room and tells John and Lacey that the president is going to call, like the president of the United States wants to call and speak to Edward, which is, of course, ridiculous. And and the aunt and uncle are shocked by this. And then Lacey touches her hair because she wants to make sure she looks okay. And her husband teases her for it because, of course, it's going to be over the phone. But, like, that felt like there was so really, but, and that's a very small moment, but it worked and it felt real because it was this small teasing between this husband and wife. And I was like, I need more where their marriage feels real like that. And then I went in and wrote new scenes for them or expanded out scenes that I already had.
It's funny you should say that because Deborah Eisenberg, the way she critiques looks at writing is whether it's accurate. And I think the word accurate is really an interesting word. It's not, it's different than truthful or authentic. I don't know. I just think that's a really interesting word choice. And as you're saying that Lacey was touching her hair in this particular way and that they were teasing each other, that's the accuracy of that in a marriage would then drive the rest of their marriage, or you could see your way through the rest of their relationship. I think that's really interesting. Yeah.
That's a very interesting word. And yeah, that's entirely it. If you can find the live spots, and often when I'm teaching too, like you can have a story that from a student that basically does not work, but there's one scene in it that's just great. And it's because it's filled with life and it feels accurate or true or whichever word you want to attach to it.
Yeah.
And so and generally as writers, particularly as young writers, it's very hard to see in your own work what works and doesn't work.
Right.
As you go along, you can get a little bit better at seeing that, but still sometimes I can be surprised by handing something to Helen and Hannah and them saying, this element is great. And I'm like, oh, really? I wouldn't have thought that. But once you realize the parts that, like, really work, then you can try to make everything else live on the same level that does.
Yes. Right. We're drawing down on our time, but we should spend our last couple of minutes talking. We keep making allusions to one story, but I'd love, you know, I'm assuming all of our listeners know about one story, but it strikes me maybe they do not. So maybe just a minute or two about one story, kind of how it works and how we can find out a little bit more about that for people who might not be aware of it.
Yeah, One Story is an amazing literary magazine. It is, I believe, in its 18th year. I may be off by a year, but I think it's the 18th year. And it was co-founded by the writer Hannah Tinty, who I mentioned already, and Mary Beth Batcha. While we were in graduate school, so 18 years ago. And their idea was, at that point, a lot of the big, famed short story journals were closing down, and they wanted to make sure that the short story as a form continued to be celebrated. And they had this idea, which is one story to send out, like, really as, like, a small envelope, one story per month. And the real beauty of it is that we're on issue number 200 and something, and the commitment was to never publish a writer more than once. So let's say we're on number 243, which we may be, we're something around there. That means that's 243 different writers that have been published by One Story.
Great.
Which, it's, to me, that's its most amazing legacy. And that's really that is a huge challenge as a very small team that yeah. runs the magazine.
Yeah.
And so there's like six of us, but most of us work part time. We have an office in Brooklyn. We also One Story also runs amazing in person and online classes. If you go to One Story, I think it's onestory.com with a hyphen between the one and the story.
Yeah, right.
But if you Google One Story Literary Magazine, it'll come right out. So you can go to the website. But we regularly offer really amazing online classes. I have one that I teach on plot, which I think is running in June. Oh, but Hannah Tinty actually is running a class that you can sign up. Will this air anytime soon?
Probably in April, early April, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be too late. It'll get run again. Hannah has a couple, like, phenomenal classes that she does online, too. And then we teach a one-story conference, summer conference in July every summer.
Yeah.
That information is also on the website, which Marie went to. And so it's adult education and fiction and a really high level of editing. And my job actually is I read the best of the slush pile.
Oh, cool.
And then I print the first two pages of each of the stories that I read, and I give those to Patrick Ryan, who is our editor, and then he and I meet, and he's read the two pages, and I've read the whole thing, and we talk about each story, and then he decides whether he wants to read the whole of any of the ones, and I try to convince him which ones I think he should read.
Hmm.
And so we do that every week so that a volunteer reader has read every story, and then they have to forward on at least one story per week to me as the best. So that way that we have multiple people reading every single story that comes in.
So great. That's so great.
Yeah.
And I can vouch for both the in-person workshop and the online classes. They're really, really wonderful, really high quality. And I always learn something new in every single one I've taken. They're so great. Any last-minute words of advice that we didn't cover? Writing advice?
The writing advice that I give the most often that maybe seems resonant, ends up being resonant for people, is that if you are my tact for when I am in the middle of a project, meaning a novel, and I've gotten sort of hopeless because it's a complete mess and I'm a few years in and I know that I have years ahead of me, and I think I stole this from Ann Patchett and slightly revised it, but I'm not entirely sure anymore, is that I commit to writing for at least 5 minutes every single day, and I don't have to do more than 5 minutes, and once I've written for 5 minutes, I put an X on my calendar, and the goal is to see how many X's in a row I can get. And if you are feeling full of sort of self-loathing or despair or feeling like this is pointless or there's, you know, you're never going to get better, if you employ that tactic, you can get yourself through that period of despair to the other side while still remaining in touch with your work. And if you are writing every day, you're going to get better.
I love that. I love that. That's so achievable. 5 minutes is so achievable. 1,000 words sometimes feels a lot, but 5 minutes feels really okay.
Yeah. And usually, of course, you'll do more than 5 minutes, but you can always like rewrite 3 sentences in that 5 minutes and feel good about yourself.
Right. I love it. Anne Napolitano, Dear Edward is the book. Is there a website we can find you in addition to One Story?
Yes, annenapolitano.com.
Yeah. Perfect. This was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I really